Hello, guys, gals, non-binary pals, Vulcans, Klingons, and other. Welcome to the Sci-Fi Lab. I'm your host, DJ Squared, and with me are my guests from last week.
I'm Karen Byers.
And I'm Kate Coker.
And this week, we're talking about Star Trek, still. But more pointedly, we're talking about Star Trek and its effects on fandom.
We're going to talk about Star Trek some more.
I mean, like, does anyone ever really get tired of talking about Star Trek?
There's a lot of it to talk about.
Yes. There's...
That helps. That gives us a long, long, long history of Star Trek from 1966 until, well, thanks to Star Trek Discovery, right now. Thank you, Star Trek Discovery, which I have enjoyed thoroughly.
Thanks, guys! I have to admit, most of my knowledge comes from the original series and the alternate original series, so that's what I'm going to be talking mostly about.
Mm-hmm.
You can never go wrong with original series. You just can't.
It's really true. It stands up really well.
Yeah.
It stands up really well. I watched the entire original series a few years ago. I think it was TBS had all three seasons streaming on their website for free. I was a little surprised at how well it did.
Yeah.
In the context of the modern world. So let's see. If we put them all in order, we've got the original series and then Next Generation, which was 1987.
Animated series. Don't forget animated series.
Everyone forgets the animated series because it's kind of like the actual stories are fine, but the animation is gross.
The animation is constantly recycled. Like, you can just watch and be like, okay, these 20 seconds I have seen in this episode, and this 30 seconds I've seen in this episode, but they get almost the entirety of the original cast back. Like,
so if you just listen to the animated series,
it's pretty good for that. So, let's see. Original series, animated series, Next Generation, and we're going to leave aside the movies for the moment, because the movies are going on, like, what's the word I'm looking for? Concurrently, thank you. With that. And then I lose the thread. What came next?
Next Gen, DS9, Voyager, Enterprise, Reboot, and then Discovery.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm a nerd.
Hey, you know, this is useful information. If somebody decides to just binge the entirety of Star Trek.
Would not recommend. No.
But it, you can.
You can. I think I read somewhere recently that it would be 23 days and 56 minutes.
Just straight through?
If you watched all of it.
All right. I mean... I could do that.
If ever anyone felt like doing a whole lot of speed or something, that would like be the best possible thing you could do.
So because Star Trek's been around a long time, and because it basically never went away, really, it's had a huge effect on fandom.
Mm-hmm.
So like starting with the original series was when we started to get the fanzines that we talked about last time. Star Trek has evolved with science fiction, so like, the original series is new wave science fiction, and then we've moved into more contemporary science fiction as, you know, needs and interests in the genre have changed.
And then there's, like, the alternate original series, which is sort of a nostalgia. It's, like, nostalgia-driven sci-fi because it's, you know, basically, like, it's the original series, just kind of shinier. And also, sorry, Benedict Cumberbatch, but you're not as good as, you're not Khan.
Thou art pale.
Okay, that one wasn't exactly his fault, because they did ask three different actors of color to play Khan before they got to Ben C.
They could have gone to actors of color 4 through 449 before they went to Benedict Cumberbatch. Okay, it's not like... There's, like, only, like, you know, three brown guys. I'm sure there are more, you know, out there, given lots of television to attest.
Very true.
And then they gave him Robert Smith's haircut, which didn't help anything.
Yeah. Sorry, Ben C. You just... It's like... There's the original series where you don't... Original series movies where you don't talk about the odd-numbered ones, and now the alternate original series where you don't talk about the even-numbered one.
Right. They just swapped.
Yes, exactly.
Just make it different. I mean, I personally enjoyed Star Trek Save the Whales, but I understand that was not everybody's cup of tea.
Everyone loves Save the Whales. Who doesn't love Save the Whales?
Save the Whales is actually very good.
It's one of the best
Star Trek movies. Cult classic.
I really consider Khan the cult classic.
I mean, yeah, but like...
Khan's the mainstream classic.
Yeah, Khan's more the mainstream classic.
Okay, fair.
Like, Save the Whales is for people who actually know the series and just sort of wants to revel in it.
And who like to see 1980s San Francisco.
Exactly.
Well, it has, like, some of, like, the best lines of all time. Like, I am well known for if I have to go to someone else's computer, I will go, "Hello, computer. Hello."
That's true. You That's know? Pretty great.
I've been doing this since I was a small child. Okay, that joke holds up.
They are not the hell of your whales.
Yes.
Well, the thing about Star Trek is because it's been around for so long, it's recognizable, like, in the mainstream pop culture, but also... It's recognizable within science fiction in a way mm-hmm. that makes it possible to parody it and to reference it. And you don't even have to clearly identify what you're talking about because it's mm-hmm. already so clearly identified what you're talking about. And I'm thinking about right now, John Scalzi wrote a book called Red Shirts.
Yeah.
That's... Where, like, you, if you know anything about science fiction, you already know, okay, well, this is about the guys who are going to walk behind this suspicious-looking rock to investigate, and then there will be a Star Trek-style explosion, which explodes, like, up and out. There's never just a quiet explosion. No. Like, people have to get blown off their feet, and then they're going to die, because then we can show that this planet is dangerous.
People chunks.
But
people
there's chunks never everywhere. Any blood. There's never any blood, and always True. The bodies are, like, you know, perfectly in one piece. It's just, you know, he's dead, Jim.
Right. They can be kind of singed. There can be, like, that makeup that makes them look like they've had, like, they've got soot on them.
Been slightly burned.
Right. But you know, that's about it.
I mean, like, this was back in the good old days when the censors were just like, hey, no.
So that was one I was thinking about. But there was also a Dark Mirror. Okay, potential spoiler alert here, depending on how detailed we get. There's a Dark Mirror episode that came out late last year that is looking at the dark side of utopia, essentially, through Star Trek. Mm. But also, I think, looking at the dark side of fandom.
Yeah. Remember, kids, there are no good fandom experiences. There are only well-curated fandom experiences.
Well, one of the things I thought was incredibly interesting about USS Callister, I've been trying to think about how to do this in a different way. But so, you know, the idea, it's like, okay, toxic masculine fanboy who doesn't have power in real life and doesn't get the attention of women decides to reenact the cage beat for beat and mistreat and abuse the virtual equivalents of the people he knows in real life, right? And so it's this idea of living in this toxic world where you get to treat everything as your toy, and that is fandom for him. He has all the toys in real life, and then he has the toys inside his virtual reality. And the thing I've been wondering about is there a way in which you could have a fandom experience in which you could have all of your toys, but it wouldn't automatically be a toxic experience? So I was thinking, what would, like, the woman fangirl who has all the toys to, like, reenact all of the abuse she has to put up with in everyday life, like, you know, all the gamers who call her the fake geek girl and all that stuff, would that or would that not be just as toxic when lived through in her fantasy world?
I would say probably yes.
Yeah.
I mean, it's different, but less toxic? I'm not sure we could say that that's going to happen.
I don't think so. Like, especially if this is, like, a revenge scenario where she's putting people through everything that she's been through, that has the potential to get very invasive very quickly. Because, like, I personally know people who have been doxxed, who've been stalked both, like, IRL and online, and it gets gross real fast. And, like, the thing is, is that it's not just, like, fans with creators. That's also fans with big-name fans.
That's true.
Yep.
And, or fans that just, like, there's this one content creator, and maybe they're not that big, but this one person just really, really likes their stuff. And then, people get obsessed easy, and then they just sort of, I don't know, turn off their normal people decision-making processes? Because for some reason, finding out where a person lives and then going to their house seems like a reasonable thing to do, suddenly.
And yet.
Yeah.
Yet it remains not a reasonable thing to do.
So yeah, so somehow that like switch in their brain gets flipped. And what they would never generally see as a reasonable thing to do to themselves suddenly becomes perfectly reasonable when it's somebody they profess to love.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure plenty of, big-name actors have to deal with various crazies.
Yeah, I read a book, gosh, this was years ago. It's actually, it's a really great book that I would recommend for anybody to read, called The Gift of Fear by Gavin DeBecker. And he talks about working with Michelle Pfeiffer, who had a number of these kinds of problems. And she said, there's a quote from her where she said, "I don't charge money for the acting, I charge money for the hassle." She's like, I act for free. The money is for all of the stuff I have to put up with, because people know my face.
Yep.
So, one thing that I think that, I mean, in a way the USS Callister kind of leads us into that, that's the Dark Mirror episode, is the idea of the Mirrorverse, which Star Trek kind of originated and which we've seen in different fan works and, you know, other science fiction. I mean, it's kind of impossible to overstate the impact of Star Trek on science fiction.
Mm-hmm.
And then sort of it osmosis-sees its way into fandom.
Yeah. I mean, Star Trek is sort of, I mean, to my way of thinking anyway, it's basically like the Lord of the Rings of science fiction. It's that sort of touchstone.
It very much is a touchstone. And there's even elements of it that I think that we see in fan fiction, but that came into science fiction literature, and I would say media more so, first. Like, I don't really recall before Star Trek that we cared, as a viewer, we really cared about the ship a lot.
Mm-hmm.
But people love the USS Enterprise. Like, there's technical manuals with the USS Enterprise. The writers and showrunners blow up the USS Enterprise to upset us as viewers. Nice. And to be like, no, we mean business. Look, we blew up the ship.
And we fall for it every time.
That's true.
I remember sitting in the theater watching Generations, and the saucer detaching and just being horrendously upset is like only a 12-year-old girl can be, I guess. Because the ship was in pieces and they were making a crash landing. And even Data dropped the S-bomb. I mean,
oh. But that's also sort of one of the interesting things in, I'm going a little bit off script here, one of the interesting things about the more contemporary science fiction, like just like short stories and drabbles and stuff that I see online, is the humans are weird, but specifically when it refers to humans pack bonding with robots. Hmm. And like, you know how human beings are super weird when it comes to their own cars or their own laptops or whatever, like, you baby talk to it. You sort of, like, stroke it, like, it's okay, you can do that. And, like, from that perspective, actually caring about the Enterprise is not at all strange. But we think about it. Like, if you take a few minutes to think about it, this is not even, like, a real machine. This is a fake machine.
Yes. Go ahead.
And we're still pack bonding with it.
And it's had an influence in the way that all of those shows work, because there's so many things about it. Like, there's the warp drive, which is in every Star Trek. And, I mean, some version of the warp, or a warp drive appears in so much other fandom stuff. And when I think about, like, Buck Rogers did not care much about his spaceship. It was just to get him from point A to point B. Whereas I'm pretty sure that Jean-Luc Picard is married to his spaceship, essentially.
I'm pretty sure I remember Kirk having some very, very loving speeches about the Enterprise.
Right. So it becomes, the ship becomes the home. It becomes something that's really meaningful in that way. And I think that that shows up in the ways that fans engage with it. Like at Dragon Con last year, it was my 14th consecutive Dragon Con. And there was a, I forget the scale, but it was big. It was probably at least 8 feet long, model of the Enterprise. And it was in this room, because Dragon Con is huge, it was in a room that was like, you had to go up some stairs and down some stairs and like take three left turns and then take two right turns and then go down some more stairs. And then like 15 minutes later, after doing all of these kinds of things, you could arrive in this room where this model was. And people were doing that because they wanted to come see the model of the Enterprise that somebody had made as a hobby. And I will say the craftsmanship was very nice. They did a really good job. They like lit up the little bay where all of the little shuttlecraft would come and land so that you could see the inside. This was obviously a work of love and a lot of time and attention.
And I know that there's also, like, people who build scale, like, Lego models of the Enterprise, people who have built it in Minecraft. I think it was in MIT where a group of students built a virtual version of the Enterprise, what's the word? Just, like, the bridge, yeah.
The bridge.
Yeah, they built a virtual reality version of the Enterprise's bridge and then invited, like, William Shatner to come and look at it. And apparently it was very impressive.
I'm glad that he thought so. He's had an interesting relationship with fans over the admittedly close to 50 years that he's been engaged with this.
I can imagine.
I will say one of my favorite things in the world, despite the Shat being a grumpy old man most of the time, is I love every time he's on Twitter and he will tweet NASA at the International Space Station and he will say, he'll say something and he'll say, aye, aye, Captain, reporting, and the real astronauts will treat the old actor as the legit captain, and aww, that just gives me warm fuzzies.
Yeah, I've seen that too. And it's also just further proof that everyone who works at NASA is a Star Trek nerd.
Many, 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 many Star Trek nerds. That is very true.
I'm pretty sure, like, if you, like, walk into a room at NASA and, like, throw a rock, you'll hit everybody in the room and they'll all be Star Trek fans.
Is it a moon rock?
I don't think you should throw the samples, so no.
If we've learned anything from original series, is the virtues of throwing rocks that are clearly made of painted styrofoam.
Yes.
That's really true.
Yes, that's true.
We've also learned that every alien has to be roughly human-sized and shaped.
Very important.
They can look like reptiles. Reptiles were popular in the original series.
I do remember Kirk, like, there's gift sets of Kirk getting into, like, the world's lamest fight
Yes, the Gorn and the lizard.
Yes.
So one thing that I also thought was interesting is when we think about Star Trek through all of this time, there's a lot of half-human people. There's Spock, for starters. There's Troy, who's half-human. There's B'Elanna Torres in one of the later series. And also we have this tendency in Star Trek to center humans and Earth in the middle of everything, because when we look at it, the Federation is based on Earth. Star Trek Academy is in San Francisco. When they're going to go back to Earth in Star Trek Save the Whales, we get to go see San Francisco in the 80s, which is great. And so it's a very human-centric vision of the future. And I think that has sort of influence the way that fans think about and talk about space exploration kinds of things.
Yeah, like either they embrace that human centricity wholeheartedly, or they go the absolute opposite direction. Everybody is at least half alien. This is my OC. She's half alien, half a different alien, and also part human. Maybe part demon.
Well, and that was also, like, a lot of, like, where some of the anti-fandom with Star Trek Discovery got going, is the fact that our protagonist, Michael Burnham, is a human who has been adopted by Sarek and his wife. Also, she's black. But ostensibly, you know, the reason people are really upset is because she's adopted by Vulcans, and that's so Mary Sue-like. And you're just kind of like,
it's like, well, first of all, not technically accurate, adopted by a Vulcan and a human.
Right. Yes. I mean, of all the Vulcans, Sarek clearly likes humans. Like, he clearly thinks we're okay.
The most likely Vulcan to adopt a human person.
Right. Yeah. And
but he also detaches himself from it a little bit because, you know, that he has it in... Minor spoiler alert, there's one episode of Discovery where he doesn't want to refer to Michael as his daughter. And so she starts calling him father to irritate him. And I thought that was so interesting in so many ways. I think that it was in Leafy, was the episode.
Mm-hmm.
And you would think, you know, you raised this girl since he was 8, Sarek. I know you're a Vulcan, but dude... But on the other hand, you know, as we've seen from his relationship with Spock in Journey to Babel, he's not like, you know, John Winchester A-plus parenting, but he's not, you know, not either.
It's really hard to be John. Like, really hard to have characters who are John Winchester levels of A-plus parenting. Like, that's an entirely different level.
So we talked about this some last time. I mean, Star Trek and fanzines, mm-hmm. and Star Trek and slash fiction, and but we didn't really talk about Star Trek and conventions.
Yeah,
because it changed the game with cons.
Mm-hmm.
It really did. Before that time, cons were more kind of fan run, and you would invite people, and it wasn't a business in the same way.
They were also small. They would usually max out at a couple hundred people.
Mm-hmm.
And now, those are barely considered cons.
Yeah, you can have a couple hundred people in a room.
Yeah. At
most cons.
Except for there was actually a local comic convention in my hometown that started up recently.
Mm-hmm.
So that has a few hundred people, but that was actually really interesting.
They still exist. Small cons mm-hmm. still exist. And fan-run cons still exist, and literature-focused cons, which many of these were previously, still exist. But having a huge media property that people loved this much really kind of changed things. And it changed mm-hmm. things for the actors, too, because all of a sudden this was a part of their job, or it could be.
Or it could be their entire job.
Mm-hmm.
The con circuit can be incredibly lucrative, depending on who you are.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I remember, it was the year before last at Dragon Con when the guy who played Lucius Malfoy came.
Oh, Jason Isaacs. He's also in Star Trek Discovery, and he's wonderful.
Well, he's wonderful in everything.
That's true.
Really. But yeah, like, you're standing there, and this is one of the main hotels, and there's a line, like... halfway around the outside of the building.
Only waiting. Halfway?
Well, it's the Jason Isaacs line hit up against, like, the Deep Space Nine panel line.
Mm-hmm.
And that one took over, like, the rest of the outside of the building. So, you know, I think the Jason Isaacs line might have doubled back on itself a little bit. Because, you know, that happens.
Yeah, not recommended for line management, but it happens.
No, Dragon Con in general needs to work on their line management.
But I also think Jason Isaacs is an interesting case, too, because he's one of those things where he is an actor who is a fan of the property before being cast in it. And so he's been quite vocal in this past year about talking about the good things about Star Trek and also pushing back against the reactionary fandom. Like, I remember there was something last fall where someone was asking him something about what would he say to, like, outright fans or something like that, and he would say, fuck them. Or, pardon my language, I'm sorry, but that was a quote.
No, it's fine, we're cool.
He said in the interview. But one of the interesting things, and I think this goes back to Shatner's, like, for a lot of the actors in Star Trek, there has historically been mixed feelings about having a fandom and engaging with it or not versus, you know, the more recent actors who have functionally kind of grown up with this and are very excited about it. So Jason Isaacs is a fanboy. He's very excited about it. Simon Pegg from Reboot.
Mm-hmm.
He loves it. And actually, there's a
and he helped make the third one.
Yeah, I mean, the third one, we also got most of the cast back because both Carl Urban and John Cho were Star Trek fans who were getting incredibly frustrated with Abrams' tenure because, A, as actors, they had nothing to do, and, B, they understood the property and Abrams didn't. And so they, I also remember during Into Darkness promos, like, John Cho just cast Magnificent Shade everywhere, and he would always remind interviewers, you know, and of course, you know, Ricardo Montalban, who played Khan, was a man of color, and he would do things like that. But because Simon Pegg was the one who was writing, he was the one who actually got all of the other actors to commit with the promise of, no, we're actually going to do Star Trek this time.
And they did.
We're going to space, and we're going to have adventures and character development.
And we're going to play at least one Beastie Boys song.
I love that Beastie Boys is classical music. That just makes my little 90s heart grow 10 times.
Well, I mean, for them, it is classical music. It's just like that episode of Doctor Who when they played Britney Spears' Toxic. And now for a classical Earth ballad.
Which also goes to, in science fiction nerd in general thing, but like I love how, like, you know, these are actually very wise nods to how low culture becomes high culture over time. Like, it happens to Shakespeare, that happens to Beethoven, it happens to everything. Beethoven would have been a punk rocker. Basically, that was how outray his stuff was a couple hundred years ago. That's awesome!
Yep. And now, like, and Star Trek has been, sort of become that, too. Like, not as much as it probably will, but it's still very, like, again, it's still a cultural touchstone. If you talk about it, people will know what you're talking about. People understand at least the basics of what's going on. And that's just, it's just super neat.
One of the things that
I'm up in Jalad at Tanagra.
One of the things that that I was going to bring up, and that's a beautiful segue, thank you, Kate, is the Universal Translator in alien languages.
Yes.
Because the Universal Translator is a neat idea that I think has populated other science fiction,
mm-hmm.
And has made its way into fan works as well. That's like, we can make technology fix our communication barrier, and then we can have social problems that we focus on instead of spending an entire episode trying to understand each other. Except mm-hmm. once they solved that problem so neatly in the narrative, they had to come back. Like, to the episode, yeah, to the episode that Kate was talking about, where it's like, what if that doesn't work, actually? Then mm-hmm. and then we're back to these situations where we don't understand each other, and fundamentally we get to understand that communication is the most important thing, and understanding other people's points of view, which comes to that sort of, up through at least the Next Generation, generally positive, hopeful, optimistic quality that mm-hmm. Star Trek brought to space exploration. I mean, we have a lot of, even the bad guys aren't completely bad, you know?
Yeah.
Even the bad guys have shades of gray. Even the Borg think they're doing the right thing. It's not the right thing because they're taking away free will, and free will is the best in Star Trek's universe. That's why we have the Prime Directive. You can't interfere with other people's way of doing things for themselves. But they're just misguided. They're not malicious. So, yeah.
And you also see a lot of that in the fan works, well, specifically like the communication issues, because most fan works, the relationships between the characters are what sort of drives everything, even if it's not like romantic or sexual. It's this group of people, I want to know what would happen if everyone for some reason could only speak in their maiden language, or
they all were back in high school, or they all worked in a coffee shop, which, I mean, now we're getting into alternative universe.
Yes.
It's its own different thing.
Which is my entire wheelhouse. I love me some AUs. Yep. And then there's Star Trek, which originated some of our, like, fandom culture tropes that you sort of see everywhere. Like, at the very least, it originated them, if not, or at least popularized them, if not officially originated them. Because
sex pollen, really made them do it, mirror universe where people have goatees.
Yes.
A universe where everything is the same, except.
Yes.
They actually did or no, I don't know if it was an origination. So, but there's an Impreg episode of Enterprise.
Oh, that's right.
They actually went there. Dude.
Science fiction has been going there for a while. I think there's a few different books on the Sci-Fi Lab shelf that have that.
An essential theme.
Yes.
Yeah, so even, well, if we go back to, I want to say that Le Guin's Left Hand of Darkness was published in 1969, which is the same year that Star Trek ended, and that was one of the first serious explorations of science fiction and gender in ways that fans have continued to engage with in lots and lots of ways ever since then.
Yeah.
I should also point out that 1969 was the moon landing. So 1969 was like right when Star Trek was like, we're going to go discover the stars. And then it got canceled. And then this is an important and interesting point. It got canceled after 2 years. And then fans were like, no, that is not okay. In the tradition of fans everywhere, when things they don't like happen.
And noped it back into existence.
They basically did.
With some help from Lucille Ball.
I did not know that.
Yeah. She was actually really instrumental in getting it back. Like, she helped with the letter writing campaigns, and she like promoted it. She's just like, no, guys, you don't understand. This needs to stay. And when Lucille Ball is telling you that something needs to stay on TV, you listen.
And thus, I love Lucy.
Yes.
And along those lines, the whole thing where Nichelle Nichols decided to stay with this show because Martin Luther King was a fan and told her so at like a fan meeting thing, and they did an whole episode about this on Drunk History recently, which was amazing, by the way. And just the immediate recognition of it is a cultural touchstone. But I also had like another thing that happened in 1969, Stonewall, in which all of a sudden, you know, that there was this kind of literal coming out of the closet of LGBT, queerness, all of those things, and they said, we are not going to go back in. And I think this is an incredibly important thing for fanzine culture, because queerness takes up a lot of space in various ways throughout print culture. But just how this has an ongoing effect on science fiction itself. Like you mentioned, Left Hand of Darkness. That's a story that is also kind of flirting in some ways with queerness and alternate sexualities, because the alien people can switch genders on a regular basis. And so for a period of time within the episode or within the book, there's like this kind of near romance sexual tension between, you know, the human biological male and the alien who is currently male. And that's just fascinating to me. / nerd.
Well, Le Guin was, she was very timely with that book, but also she's just a genius, so, in her writing. So, One other thing that I thought was really interesting, going back to the universal translator in languages, is like there are, Klingon is by far the most well-known, but there are a bunch of made-up languages. Yep. And Klingon has really taken root in fandom. Like, people learn Klingon phrases. Some people actually learn Klingon. There are, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Have you ever heard that story of, like, a person who went to a Star Trek convention, and he was trying to talk to this other fan, but she was French, and neither of them spoke, like, he didn't speak French, she didn't speak English, but they both spoke Klingon.
No, but that's beautiful.
And then apparently they, like, ended up getting married. I'm hoping that they said their vows in Klingon, but...
With an original story like that, how can you not?
Exactly. You have to take the opportunities that are presented to you.
Well, one of my favorites is the Folger Shakespeare Library in D.C. totally has a copy of the Shakespeare in Klingon book.
Yes, I was going to bring that up. Because, yeah, there's entire works of Shakespeare. There's a throwaway line in one, I can't remember. Huh?
Undiscovered Country.
Thank you. About how Hamlet's better in the original Klingon, and somebody took on the challenge and translated it, and then it's been published, and now is in the premier Shakespeare library in America.
But is it better in the original Klingon?
I have not actually seen a production in Klingon. I don't feel qualified to address that question.
So somebody out there, get on it. We know you're out there.
Some Shakespeare class somewhere has to be willing to do this. Somewhere. It just has to happen.
Come on, guys. You need to do it for the fandom. For everyone.
Fandom needs you. It's time to step up. So there's a lot of little details about the Star Trek world that fans get really engaged in. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, there's the science and the engineering, of course, but there's also stuff like tri-dimensional chess. Like, they made up a whole game, and that's a thing that people...
And now there are competitions for it.
Right, exactly. That people who like chess anywhere were like, well, Star Trek really gets me. And now they do this as part of, you know, their fan-ish stuff.
And every single Spurk fan fiction you will ever read will have them playing at least one game of tri-dimensional chess.
In which Jim Kirk does not know how to play.
Yeah.
Yes. That's how those go.
That's how that happens.
Yes. And then this is an interesting thing to see how fans use it in fan works, but the holodeck, which sort of as a narrative device gives you this unlimited capacity for where else. It's sort of like an alternate universe built into the fabric of the ship where you can be like, well, today I'm going to make them be detectives in the noir era. And...
I'm going to live my own Sherlock fanfic.
Yes. Like I said last time, Star Trek has been nodding in the direction of Sherlock for a long, long time.
Yup.
And it sometimes has gone from the occasional nod to full on, like, I'm going to fan at you super hard for 47 minutes in a row.
We're just going to throw it all at you. It's fine. And that probably happens a lot where, like... I haven't read any fanfiction with the holodeck involved, but I'm pretty sure that the holodeck probably breaks where they're stuck inside the simulation.
Yes, which is something they did, they took straight out of the show, but it can be a way to explore relationships and characters, which is the kind of stuff that fanfic often likes to do.
Lock two people in a closet, see what happens.
Like, lock two people in the holodeck, see what happens.
It's the same thing. It's the same thing as those fanfictions where two characters get stuck in an elevator. All right?
This is way better than an elevator. Well, potentially it's way better.
Potentially.
It could be worse.
It could be very much worse. You're in an elevator, but there's a giant spider.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. It depends on what the holodeck is doing. How broken is it? Is it broken when you're, you know, in, like, this beautiful world that's full of, like, meadows and beaches and ponies? Nice ponies.
Nice
ponies. Friendly ponies.
Not demon horses.
Right. Or is it a situation where, like...
trying to kill you.
Yeah. Well, horses are always at least partially trying to kill you. But, my own personal horse bias coming into play here.
All right. Noted. DJ does not prefer horses.
So the My Little Pony episode is, like, totally just... gone now, I guess, huh?
Well, like, there's a difference between, like, Technicolor cartoon horses and actual horses. But if we're talking about My Little Pony, we're probably going to be talking about bronies. And that's an entirely different kettle of fish.
It is, but it is an interesting kettle. Because while fans have often been traditionally depicted as men, fandom, as we talked about previously, at least when it comes to things like fan fiction and fan works, is largely self-identified as women.
Mm-hmm.
So the bronies are, in a way, a kind of an exception to the way that that's put together.
Yeah, but they still ruined that show for me, and I can never watch it again.
Oh no!
It was a cute show with good music, and it taught good lessons, but they ruined it. With all of their grossness. That was nasty.
So fandom has its dark sides. Fandom is not a perfect place. Kate and I have definitely spent some quality time thinking and writing about this.
Hmm.
But fandom is not separate from the culture that it's created in.
No.
It is marinating in all of these issues and biases and problems that we face when we're trying to create an original work or just trying to live our lives and get through our days.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes people idealize it.
Yeah. And that's when you start to get things like just the all of the fandom infighting about, like, hey, maybe you really shouldn't be shipping that. Like, it's kind of messy. Don't tell me what to do. Don't. I'll ship whatever I want to. I don't care. And then you're just like, okay.
And you particularly see, like, squicky stuff. Like
yeah.
Apparently it was not uncommon. Like, I never read much Voyager fic. I read some of it, but one of my friends of color remembers it was not just a notable exception. You saw it a lot where fan writers cannot deal with Tuvok the Black Vulcan speaking standard English. And so they had to do faux abonnets for him. Because...
Did they, though?
Did they really?
Apparently it ruined Star Trek fandom for her for many years to, like, you know, see this great character treated horribly in the fic over and over and over and over and over. And you can definitely get the sense of... We have this narrative of fandom as this welcoming, happy place. And the unfortunate truth is this is not always true. It can be a happy, safe place for some of us, but not always for all of us. And that's something that definitely needs to be recognized and worked on more.
I mean, it is a group of people, so you're always going to have some nastiness.
Right, there's always going to be the same tendencies as any group of people.
Yeah.
But choosing not to acknowledge that hampers it even more.
Yeah.
Than just saying, well, you know, we're human and we make mistakes and sometimes we're thoughtless and, you know, sometimes people are mean and there need to be limits on what they can do. And instead of being like, but everything's great here. We hold hands and sing Kumbaya.
Except for no, we don't. Right. No, we don't, guys.
Except for no, we don't.
Except for no.
And as we, you know, see increasingly in our current culture, it's like, there are Nazis out there. A, call them Nazis, and B, say they are evil. This is pretty basic.
Yes.
Yeah. And yet.
So that was basically the last article that Kate and I published in, what, a 3-minute summary?
Sure. Nazis are bad, but they are also in fandom, and that is also bad.
Right. And we encourage you to think about that.
Please. Please think about that. And, like, then there's also, like, specifically talking about, like, the kind of gross parts of fandom, especially the more racist parts of fandom, there's always the... there's that question of, are you shipping what you're shipping because it's actually a good dynamic or because you don't like the person they actually ended up with. Or, like, in alternate original series, you know, Uhura and Spock were together and everything.
Race Fail 09. Reboot comes out in 2009, and the whole Spock-Uhura thing is very much a casualty of that massive fandom wank. And the anti-Uhura stuff that was posted was just WTF-ery. And again, with the iterating of, you know, fandom, it should be a place for all of us, and all of a sudden, some spaces, it becomes very clear that it is not. And so the creation of other sub-communities, some who are hidden because they don't want to deal with, you know, the trolls and, you know, the scariness coming into it.
Yeah. Kate, could you define wank for the purposes of fan behavior?
Oh.
It just occurred to me that all of our listeners may not know that term in this context.
Yeah.
Okay,
I just realized that too. Oh, gosh.
So fan wank is an ongoing argument, often including lots of trollish behavior. It's a sort of thing where it will be the same kind of argument you have over and over again, or someone deliberately going into a space to be deliberately provocative. There it can also be used in the context of just any kind of problematic behavior or recurring issue. Is that kind of
good? That sounds good. And some of the problematic behaviors that can arrive from this, and I think it's worth noting that this is the kind of argument that cannot be resolved, because it's essentially, I think this character is this thing. Well, you're wrong. No, I'm not. Yes, you are. No, I'm not. Yes, you are.
And then it devolves into 5-year-olds in a sandbox.
Right.
Fighting over a toy truck.
Exactly. Exactly. And people can, in some notable instances, behave very badly. There can be doxing. There can be
permabanning.
Yes. There can be, what was the other word I was thinking of? Sock puppets, which is where a fan will go and create another account that looks like someone else, that looks like a different person, if you don't know any better, and essentially take advantage of bystanders' goodwill by jumping in and being like, I agree with this person, and this other person was super mean to me. I can't show you any receipts, but they were. And it's stirring up more trouble. So essentially somebody creating these alter egos, and you can have, I mean, quite a few. The internet does not really limit people in that way. So a lot of times it's just people who want to have the I'm right, you're wrong fight. But from time to time, it escalates into worse behavior.
Yeah. And seeing as fandom is so public now, because largely because of Star Trek, we all have to deal with that. Because it doesn't stay on the fan sites or in the fan letters anymore. Mm-hmm. You'll find it on your Facebook feed.
That's true. If you didn't like somebody in the older days of fandom, then you just didn't talk to them at the bar at the con.
Yeah.
And, you know, maybe you'd complain about them to your friends. But
now you can get into Twitter fights.
Now you can get into Twitter fights with strangers you've never met.
Well, there was definitely wank in the old days. I'm trying to remember who it was. There's a notorious case in the 40s where someone was sending out, like, death announcements for, like, their enemy, basically.
Nice!
Like, well, by the way, so-and-so died. You need to take them off all of the fanzine lists
because
house now, you don't want to send the mail there. And it was, you know, snail mail. It took, you know, at least, I think, a month or two for him to be like, no, I'm alive. Keep sending me my zines, please.
Reports of my death have been greatly exaggerated.
Exactly.
That's awesome. I mean, it's terrible. But how petty.
The level of pettiness is very nearly admirable.
I mean, That is fantastically petty.
Yeah, we think a lot was invented with the internet, and in fact, no, it wasn't. We just did stuff on the internet differently.
Yeah.
And faster.
Yeah, that's the thing. All of these fights are allowed to blow up to epic proportions with the entire fandom's involvement because of Twitter.
And very quickly. Very quickly. If you wanted to have a fight in, like, the letter column of a fanzine, if you wanted to, say, like, write a letter of comment, which was sort of, like, this lengthy sort of ramble of, like, here's my thoughts about different things, or things that other people have said, you know, then that could take... If you wanted to have an exchange back and forth twice, then you're looking at, like, a minimum of 4 months.
Yeah.
Unless you're actually writing them to each other, in which case, why would you...
Why are you doing this?
Yeah.
What... So at the very least, save on postage. Come on, guys. Oh, I love... there's this one picture of a telegram that I keep... That I see every once in a while on Tumblr. And it says... It's a telegram. And all it says is, fuck you. Strong letter to follow.
That wasn't enough. Now when you need more words to explain your feelings.
Just, it's the, like, they had to tell this person as fast as humanly possible. So it's just strong letter to follow. I feel like they wrote the letter first and then decided that it wasn't fast enough. So they went and got the telegram.
I cannot wait 3 days to hear back on you.
If I could say something awful to you today, why not?
Yeah. Which is the entirety of the YouTube comments section.
Entirety of, like, almost every comment section, really.
It's so true.
It's true.
Except for maybe the Yahoo Answers comment section.
Those are generally not that helpful, but at least
they're not malicious. Helpful, but they're not, like, mean.
They're, yeah. So this sort of brings us back to an idea we were talking about last time, which is that fans are fans, and the medium through which fans connect has changed, and the speed at which that's possible has changed. But fans are highly opinionated people.
Yeah.
And that part's pretty much the same.
Yeah. It just looks worse than it is because, again, we're all interconnected and can yell at each other more effectively now. You scream into the void, and then the void screams back, and also downvotes.
Okay, can I borrow that? Permission to borrow that, please?
Yeah, go for it.
Thank you. That's great.
Well done, DJ. Well done.
I am a wealth of quotes. I am incredibly quotable.
So is there anything you wanted us to talk about that we didn't cover?
I think we should at least say a bit more about the sort of fandom tropes that were sort of absorbed from Star Trek and other fan fictions.
And I think a lot of those came from Star Trek. It's from the show itself. Like, the fan writers did not necessarily, like, be like, you know what would be great? If I make these characters go to this planet and encounter some weird plant, and now they have no inhibitions. Star Trek, the show, did that.
Nice.
Like, the original series did that. No, that was not something fans came up with, but it was something that fans gleefully adopted.
Yes.
And that has become a trope that goes across all kinds of boundaries now.
Everything. There.
I remember ages ago in the Fandom Secrets Live Journal, there was a brilliant one where someone admitted that they had always thought that Ponfar had to be a fan thing, and they talked when they actually went and watched Star Trek, like, oh, there's an entire episode about this.
Right, yeah, no, fans...
It's like, no. No, this is, in fact, very much a real thing.
So that's it. I mean, these are things that started in the show, and then they end up in fandom for completely unrelated fandoms.
Yeah. It's super funny, like, which fandoms sort of, like, adopt certain aspects, like, certain tropes. Because it's different, like, you wouldn't expect some of these things. No. Yeah,
so there's, What we're talking about here is sort of a rate of transfer of ideas across fandoms. So somebody might read something and be like, this is a great idea, and it works in this world, and you know what? I'm going to make it work in this other world.
I'm going to alter it just a little bit, and then we're going to stick it in here and see what happens.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like the wingfic thing, I remember coming out of nowhere during Lord of the Rings fandom, but then it kept going, and apparently it originated in the manga that eventually was imported to the U.S. in translation.
Wait, do you know which manga?
I don't know, but I have access to the Google.
Yeah. 'Cause she's a trained Googler.
Yeah.
Yes, I do
love wingfic. I don't know why. It's just this one character, or maybe all characters have wings.
There you go. There's a really, really well done story that is sort of a takeoff of that. It is a professionally published book now called In Other Worlds by Sarah Reese Brennan, and I think you might enjoy it.
Yay.
Actually, I would recommend it to anybody. It is a great story about essentially the kid who gets picked to go to magic school, except wait, no, he hates magic school. And everybody at magic school, except this one beautiful elf maiden that he's completely nuts about, and he has to prove that he's good enough for her.
Nice.
So I totally, totally recommend, which is just a takeoff of where different place that we're going. So another thing, while Kate is doing the Googling.
I have the Google answer, and Google has a plot twist for us, actually.
Ooh, do go on.
So according to fan lore, Wings and Fanworks, it has the exact date of the emergence of wingfic as a genre is uncertain. It might have already existed in professionals fandom, and it existed in Star Trek fandom in the 1980s.
Whoa.
So it doesn't mention the manga thing at all. The story of it coming through manga in the 2000s is what I heard, who knows when. But nope, I take it back. Apparently was it just a thing in the 80s, man.
So apparently, as far as we are aware, wingfic got its start in the Star Trek.
That's a very real possibility. That's a very real possibility. Which actually, this brings up another point, which is that there is a bunch of fan fiction. One tends to think that all the fan fiction in the world exists on the internet, but it is not actually true. And there's bunches and bunches of fan fiction that have not been scanned or uploaded, and that are available only in fanzines that have been preserved since that time. Which means that actually, if there's anybody listening to this and you want to do some serious work in fan studies, this is your master's thesis. You're welcome. I would say that that's a pretty serious research project to go back through the fanzines of the 80s and see if you can pinpoint when this got started.
Yeah.
And just to add, major fanzine library resources, Texas A&M, University of Iowa, University of California at Riverside. Most of these institutions have really nice library websites where they are already inputting material online for you, and at the very least have catalogs where with the touch of a single button, you can request copies, often for cheap. So think about that. And remember, librarians are your friends.
That's really true. The people who do work with these kinds of materials, which like Kate has done and which I do in a different way with more contemporary works, we really like to talk to you about this. You are not bothering us.
In fact, you will make our day.
Yes.
If you write to us or call us.
Yes.
Please come ask questions.
Please come ask questions. One other thing I wanted to talk about is that Star Trek's not the first or the only thing to do this, and I've definitely seen it come up in fan works, is that AI is problematic.
Yeah, I saw that it was actually like the codifier of this trope.
Yeah, so AI is very problematic. We have this natural language computer that is everywhere in the ship that we, for whatever reason, don't seem to feel as creeped out by as we do about having Alexa in our house laughing at us.
Well, the ship generally doesn't laugh at them, though.
That's true. But also, nobody seems to feel like their privacy is being invaded, which is a different kind of question, and shows me that this show was made in the 80s.
Actually,
for Next Gen.
When you think about like people who are on like reality shows and stuff, or like they've seen this phenomenon in like The Amazing Race, just like eventually you just get used to the camera, like you don't even notice anymore, like the camera people that are following you around apparently. So
I could see that, but one of the things that Star Trek did not engage with is the fact that you've got the computer everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
Like the, and I think that if that show was made today, we might have more thoughts about that. Yeah. Whereas at the time, it just seemed cool and futuristic, which it is. But nobody was talking about selling their data either.
Yeah. So,
but the way that that's kind of changed, Kirk in the original series talks self-aware and computers into self-destructing at least twice, maybe three times. And the Enterprise chugs along pretty well most of the time. And then occasionally we get an episode where the computer goes nuts and nobody can do anything.
Well, yeah. I was going to bring up the time. I think it's in, I'm blanking on the name of the episode. I want to say it's like tomorrow was yesterday or something like that. But a recurring gag throughout the episode is off in between episodes, the Enterprise had stopped off somewhere for maintenance work and upgrades. And they stopped at a place that was actually a matriarchal planet. And they were irritated that the female voice of the ship was, like, too subservient. So they decided to, like, program with sarcasm. So there's an entire episode where Kirk will ask the computer to do something. And it will say, "Yes, dear." And it's brilliant. And, like, it's a time travel episode. So it's a guy from the 1960s who's, like, looking horrified. And, like, almost everything. But, like, when Kirk is talking to the computer, he goes, "Yes, dear." And he's like, "Ah." And Kirk is like, "It's not normally like that." And
and something that's very similar to that, actually, is recently there's the TV show that's coming out that's playing now called The Good Place.
Yes.
Which is
so good.
So good. And that's, like, Janet and Bad Janet.
Yes, which is sort of like Mirrorverse Janet.
Yes, it is Mirrorverse Janet. Because so, Janet is this all-knowing being, and she's helpful. And except for when she's Bad Janet. Bad Janet is not helpful. That is, like, her entire purpose. She still knows everything.
But she's not really interested in being useful to you.
She doesn't care, no.
So... But I think
that... Does that mean that Q is Mirrorverse all the time, then?
That's probably true.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I think one of the things that shows up in the fan works around Star Trek, and that, you know, perhaps in other fan works as well, is this, like, technology's super great, but it can't be too smart?
Yeah.
Or that's weird. Humans are still the best and need to be in charge.
And also, one of my favorite episodes, Court Martial, has, mm-hmm. like, a little mini defense of print books, because Kirk is getting sued for the unjust death of a person who is actually faking their own death, and hijinks ensue. But basically, he finds the only lawyer willing to take up his case is this quirky old guy who has an office filled with print law books. And everyone kind of looks askance at that. But he makes a great little speech about how print is unchangeable, unlike computers. And that comes in later in the episode because it turns out that the computer record had been falsified. And I think that's great, although as a print historian I can talk more about, you know, print is actually never stable as we want it to be because editions and so forth, textual variations. But that early kind of anxiety around print in the 1960s is pretty great.
Yeah, so that's something that I think we still see, like, worked out culturally, where some people, I mean, I don't know if this...
My sister refuses to get an e-reader.
And some people do. But I will say, speaking as a practicing librarian, and, you know, Kate, I'm sure you can corroborate this with your experiences too, when you go to parties and people say, "What do you do?" and you say, "I'm a librarian," they say, "They still have those?"
Excuse you, libraries are making a comeback.
Libraries never went anywhere. Well, we've always been around. But
there's also more of them are being built.
That's true. Actually, in Fulton County, which is where Georgia Tech is located.
Yes.
So this idea that if you have all of your information digitized, you don't need anything else is something that Star Trek is uneasy with, that I think was sort of prescient, because we're still working that out.
Mm-hmm.
As a culture.
Yeah. And I think
on that mildly somber note, we're going to end things off this episode. So thanks for listening.